KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is KAEB 91.9 on your FM dial. Your one-stop shop in Sandpoint from classic oldies to banging new modern.
From KMXT in Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund. In recognition of the fishing industry, which provides more than 50,000 Alaskan jobs from a renewable source.
Pollock A season is wrapping up in the Bering Sea with solid returns across the board. Weather interruptions caused some hiccups along the way, but nothing outside the norm for the region. But there are a few new factors worrying the industry, including cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and expanded tariffs on seafood. KUCB's Andy Lusk has the story.
Pollock keeps the lights on in Unalaska, oftentimes known by the name of its international port, Dutch Harbor. That's the country's largest fishing port by volume. Alaska Pollock is also the largest commercial fishery in the U.S. by volume. This year's total allowable catch for the Bering Sea Pollock fishery is slightly higher than it was last year. That means fishermen can collectively harvest just under 1.5 million metric tons of pollock before calling it quits and heading back to shore. Frank Kelty is a former mayor of Unalaska and the city's current fisheries advisor. He spent half a century in town and knows its biggest revenue source well.
Overall, fishing's been very strong for the whole season. And that's what we saw in the B season, and that's what we saw last season, too. So it's been very, overall, very steady.
Pollock A season typically runs from mid-January to the end of April, with a separate B season from June to October. Kelty says right now, fish are coming in at medium sizes.
They won't be the real monster fillets, but they'll still be a good product.
But Kelty has his eye on a few developments at the national level that could cause industry-wide disruptions. He says competition with Russian seafood products is still top of mind, but there are new ones too, like expanded tariffs recently announced by the Trump administration and cuts to federal regulatory agencies. That includes the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. The agency oversees the sprawling pollock fishery.
I'm very concerned on what's going on with NOAA. That it's really could be dangerous to us in the Bering Sea.
Some NOAA employees who were fired in February have since been reinstated, but are on non-duty status, which means they haven't actually returned to work. Kelty says he's concerned about how that could affect future surveys in the region. He cites issues with getting the snow crab fishery open in 2020 when there was no survey due to the pandemic.
Industry couldn't come up with a way to do it themselves with NOAA personnel because it was COVID, so none of the NOAA people were working. We had no survey, so we didn't have a season. So the next year when we did have a season, there was no crab, and we didn't have the information ahead of time.
Unicy is a Japanese-owned seafood processing company with a plant in Dutch Harbor. Tom Enlow is the company's CEO. He shares similar concerns.
I think it's pretty apparent that the industry's facing a lot of challenges. I think it's one of the most challenging times that I can recall the industry as a whole.
Concerns over tariffs in particular are popping up across the seafood industry. This comes as the state's industry is coming off a tough couple of years of low prices and challenging market conditions. In response, two seafood trade groups that represent part of the Bering Sea pollock fleet penned their concerns to the federal government in an open letter last month. The At Sea Processors Association and the Pacific Seafood Processors Association argue new tariffs imposed by the U.S. could prompt even further strain on Alaska seafood exports. Enlow similarly calls tariffs an obstacle for the industry.
They prohibit, you know, us continuing to do business with our trade partners. The timing of all of it, this is really difficult for us to take. And so we hope that, you know, some things will get excluded or relaxed, seafood being one of them.
Nevertheless, in the short term, Enlow considers this A season to be a success. He says prices are improving over last year's for surimi in particular. That's a pollock product often used as a crab substitute. He expects to know more about where markets stand after the Seafood Expo Global Conference, which takes place next month in Barcelona, Spain. In Unalaska, I'm Andy Lusk.
Statewide support of the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Satellite Technical Services, providing satellite communication solutions for commercial fishermen across the state of Alaska. Information and dealers can be found at satellitewest.com or by calling 206-321-6896.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Comfish Alaska just finished up in Kodiak. Comfish is the biggest commercial fishery trade show in Alaska and offers a triple scoop Sunday of informational forums, updates on the politics of the day, and the opportunity to personally interact with fishermen, salesmen, managers, and legislators. However, NOAA Fisheries Dr. Bob Foy, who gave a pair of presentations, was unable to attend in person due to the federal funding environment.
As you've probably read in the newspaper, a lot of changes in our agency, and there's a travel freeze right now, and I wasn't just able to convince folks that I needed to be in Kodiak this week. So,
Dr. Foy's second presentation was on the need to modernize the way we do stock assessment surveys. The first reason is the scope of the survey area.
The Gulf of Alaska and the Aleutian Islands, Eastern Bering Sea, and then to the north, the Northern Bering Sea and Beaufort Sea, all represent unique ecosystems. This means that the oceanography that supports the fisheries in these regions is different. This means that the animals and the food webs in these different areas are different. This means that how much fish each of these areas can hold is different. And just to put this in perspective, you know, the whole area for Alaska is 1.5 million square nautical miles. We have commercial fisheries in three of them, or three and a quarter of them, and in the federal waters. We have commercial fishery species moving towards the north. And for perspective in other regions, the West Coast is one large marine ecosystem. The entire East Coast is one large marine ecosystem. So what that means is as we are collecting information in Alaska, we need to keep moving. We need to collect data over an area that's astoundingly large. So survey modernization is critical.
The second reason is the rapid shifts we are now seeing in fish stocks.
As we saw in 2019, the cod stock moved 1,000 kilometers to the north in less than 20 months. It has come back, most of the way into the Eastern Bering Sea as temperatures have cooled back off. But that event showed us that we need to be in all of these areas, and we needed a footprint in the Northern Bering Sea, for instance. That meant that we needed to modernize how we collect those data.
Which brings us to the question of the hour.
So how are we modernizing it? So one way is to update the survey design. In roughly 2018, we made a decision because of a lack of resources and to not sample in the deeper waters of the Bering Sea. We just weren't able to conduct the extra days at sea and collect data there. That had an impact on commercial fisheries such as turbot that need data to inform management. So one of our modernization tools moving forward is to try and figure out how we can do that more efficiently, so or do other work more efficiently so we can go back and get some information from those deeper waters. How can we collect and incorporate additional technology? eDNA is a tool that allows us to collect water and understand what might have been in that water and understand the genetics of the different fish species. And in some cases, it's allowing us to say that in this water over this period of time, X percent was this flatfish species or X percent was this pelagic species. So we're building new tools to help us better understand what's in the ocean that can expand our footprint in the ocean, to do it in a way that saves us money and allows us to go farther. We're using tools like artificial intelligence. That's part of the modernization. We're increasing our capacity for environmental sampling on drones, for instance. We're working with our partners to collect information on temperature in the ocean from moorings and from drones and from satellites. And all of this is to improve our overall footprint, to detect change, and to modernize how we go about spending taxpayer dollars and informing commercial fisheries.
Another way to get more bang for the buck could be survey stacking.
And then lastly is increasing our capacity to consider a number of different tools all at once. How can we look at acoustics and oceanography, look at marine mammals all at the same time and conduct these surveys concurrently. In some cases, we're doing this with our partners as well and other agencies.
They're also looking at bugs now.
Some of these other tools, again, help us understand lower trophic levels. So for instance, zooplankton. You might say, okay, Bob, you're out there sampling bugs. Why is this important? Well, actually, in the Bering Sea, as an example, when we look at the change in a warm year to a cold year, it changes the different species of copepod that's in the water column. The fat content of that invertebrate is different, and that changes how the condition of pollock changes in the Bering Sea. We can then look at that. We can look at what the plankton are to help us predict how well the pollock will recruit in the Bering Sea 3 years later.
So, more efficient methods, better technology, and a little predictive science are the prescription for stock assessments that are more effective and easier on the wallet.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amsea.org or 907-747-3287.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Matson, providing twice weekly service to Alaska's Emerald Isle.
The rest of the story. Everybody in Canton, Ohio knew the Falwell Building, a huge place, mostly occupied by a department store. Because of heavy daytime traffic, the Falwell Building was cleaned and otherwise maintained, mostly at night. An entire night crew was employed for the purpose. I want you to meet one member of that night crew, Murray Spangler, the building's janitor. Murray was a rather slight, inobtrusive man, not the sort who would easily attract attention. But then the cough started. It was occasional at first, little more than a tickling in Murray's throat, but the cough persisted. Emily the scrub woman noticed it almost before Murray did. What was the matter? She'd ask. Oh, a touch of grip, maybe, Murray would answer, and then he'd say it would go away, but it did not. And some nights the coughing became hacking. Other members of the maintenance crew staff noticed until eventually everybody was asking what on earth was the matter with Murray. Tuberculosis, somebody suggested. Consumption, deadly, communicable. But Murray never coughed during the day, only at night when he was actually inside the Falwell building. Of course, that was the cardinal clue to the rest of the story. For Murray Spangler's number one job as janitor was carpet sweeping. And all of the miles and miles of rugs in the Falwell building were Murray's responsibility. And yet as he pushed the giant carpet sweeper, he raised enough dust into the air to trigger an allergic reaction. And over the months, and then the years, Murray's allergy worsened. Sometimes the coughing became so violent that Murray simply could not continue his chore. Often fellow workers heard asthmatic gasping in the distance and rushed to discover Murray in a state of helpless exhaustion. The growing sympathy for him was such that other members of the night crew frequently cleaned the carpeting in addition to their own assigned responsibilities. Now, if Murray had simply been a goof-off, things probably would have gone on that way until the staff got fed up and he got fired, surely never to be heard from again. But Murray was not a goof-off. In fact, he was so determined to earn an honest living that he started tinkering on his own time with electric fans and rolling dust pans and broom handles and old pillowcases until he had rigged up a device which could inhale carpet dust without exhaling any. And yes, the device worked. And Murray used it in his janitor's job. And that's precisely how his illness ended and something more significant began in 1907 for the upright dust bag bearing electric vacuum cleaner has been the loyal companion of homemakers in each generation since, and yet few of us have realized its origin in the hands of an asthmatic janitor named Murray Spangler. But the man who ultimately purchased the rights to his invention was a small town harness maker named William H. Hoover. And for a generation, the Hoover vacuum cleaner became like all one word to the housewives of the world. And now you know the rest of the story.
You're listening to Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed a closely watched education funding bill yesterday. The bill would have boosted basic per student funding, known as the base student allocation, by $1,000. He announced the veto at a news conference in Juneau.
There were really two reasons for the veto. One of the reasons is that the revenue situation has deteriorated a lot since we submitted the bills and worked off of budget in December. And the second reason for the veto is there's no policy in the bill.
The veto was widely expected. Dunleavy has called for any school funding increases to be tied to policy changes that he says would boost student performance. Lawmakers had been working with the governor's staff since early this year on a compromise that included a funding boost and policy changes, but negotiations appeared to break down in recent weeks. The bill that reached the governor's desk contained nothing aside from the funding boost. The bill passed with a one-vote majority in each chamber, and it requires a two-thirds majority to override the governor's veto. But House Speaker Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham independent who leads the Democrat-heavy House Majority Caucus, says he hopes the vote highlights the importance of increased school funding.
Our public school system in Alaska is in crisis, and that's something that we need to focus on.
At the news conference for the veto, Dunleavy announced a new, competing bill that would boost basic school funding by roughly half as much. And Dunleavy says it would make it easier to create new charter schools and allow students to apply to attend schools outside their home district. Police say a kicked-out car window led to a man's fatal shooting Wednesday night in South Anchorage. 24-year-old Michael Nelson is charged with first- and second-degree murder. Police have not publicly identified the victim. According to a charging document, Nelson and two other men were in a parked vehicle when the victim walked up to it and got into a dispute with them. When the victim kicked out a window of the car, Nelson allegedly got out and wrestled with him, telling one of the other men to get a gun from a nearby home. Once Nelson had the gun, police say he chased the victim until the man stopped and turned around. That's when Nelson allegedly shot him several times. Medics who responded at about 5 p.m. Wednesday took the man to a local hospital, where he later died. Police say Nelson told them his dog lived in the car and was hurt when the man kicked in the window. According to the charges, he said, quote, "I was not going to let that slide." Nelson is being held at the Anchorage Correctional Complex. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Juneau City-run Emergency Warming Center closed for the season Wednesday. It's meant to be a last resort for unhoused people to survive the cold winter nights when temperatures drop below freezing. Juneau continues to grapple with a housing shortage, and the city-run summer campground is closed. As KTOO's Clarice Larson reports, some shelter clients say they have nowhere else to go.
The steel door slams behind him as Benjamin Stepitin steps outside of Juneau's emergency warming shelter on Wednesday morning. He slings a garbage bag with an extra pair of jeans and a few blankets over his shoulder.
I don't know what I'm going to do tonight. I have nowhere to go.
For the next 5 months, he doesn't know where he'll be sleeping each night.
So I'll be camping out somewhere tonight because I can't come back here.
Stepitin is one of 36 people who stayed at the shelter on Tuesday night. It's the second year it's been located in an industrial warehouse in Thane, about a mile from downtown. Staff from St. Vincent de Paul, a local nonprofit that works to help people affected by homelessness, operates it. Like many of their clients, Stepitin has been staying at the shelter almost every night since it opened in October of last year. While some patrons have been able to secure temporary housing at Juneau's year-round shelters ahead of the closure, staff say most patrons haven't. The shelter saw an average of 45 people a night throughout the season. And though spring has technically come, it's still cold out. Last year, some patrons were given camping gear, but not today. They didn't have tents to offer.
The best I can do right now is get some cardboard, and I could put that down and lay on that, you know. That just helps a little bit.
Another patron, Marvin Holmes, sits sipping coffee as the lights turn on at the shelter at 6 a.m. sharp. He's new to Juneau, and it's his first time experiencing homelessness beyond the shelter.
This place is not going to be here, and at which point, I don't know what to do. And all these guys, they know how to get a tent, go somewhere, get out the elements. I want to be finished tonight here, and I'm really scared.
Whitney Gannon knows what that's like. She became homeless in Juneau after she escaped a domestic violence situation 2 years ago. Now, she's the shelter's manager, and it's her mission to help people like her get into housing and feel safe.
There's so many different reasons why these people come here, but this is literally their last stop before it's actually the street.
When she lost access to housing, she was able to stay at the Mill Campground, a city-run campground for people experiencing homelessness. However, the Juneau Assembly decided to close it down last summer after an increase in illegal activity. Instead, Juneau Assembly members opted for what's called dispersed camping, essentially allowing people to sleep on public land that isn't technically a campground. Last June, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that cities can ban people from sleeping and camping in public places. This is Deputy City Manager Robert Barr explaining how that affects Juneau's enforcement of homeless encampments.
If a group of folks are camping in a given spot on public land, we are unlikely to take much enforcement action if we're not seeing uncontrolled garbage, the presence of drugs, illegal drugs, or if we're not getting a lot of public complaints. Probably not going to do much, right?
but it's up to the discretion of the city and police to decide when a campground crosses the threshold to require enforcement or dismantling. He says that's the hard part.
I don't think that the topic is going anywhere. I think it's something that we're going to have to continue to struggle through as a community for years.
Back at the shelter Wednesday morning, patrons funnel into a city bus to be dropped off downtown or in the Mendenhall Valley. Where they end up tonight is up to them. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
This is Alaska Public Media.
When the little bluebird, who has never said a word, starts to sing, spring, spring. When the little bluebell in the bottom of the dell starts to ring, ding, ding. When the little blue clerk in the middle of his work starts a tune to the moon up above. It is nature, that's all. Simply telling us to fall in love. And that's why birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. In Spain, the best upper sets do it. Lithuanians, and let's do it, let's do it, let's fall in love. The Dutch in old Amsterdam do it, not to mention the Finns. Folks in Siam do it, think of Siamese twins. Some Argentines without means do it. People say in Boston even beans do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Romantic sponges, they say, do it. Oysters down in Oyster Bay do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Cold Cape Cod clams, gainst their wish, do it. Even lazy jellyfish, do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Electric eels, I might add, do it. Though it shocks them, I know. Why ask if shad do it? Way to bring me shad row in shallow shoals. English souls do it. Goldfish in the privacy of bowls do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
Yeah, good morning out here in Southwest Alaska. Another beautiful day in paradise. And thank goodness it's Friday. We'll start out with the Dillards with Black Mountain Rag. After that, Ivy Anderson with Mexican Joe. And then Arthur Smith with Guitar Boogie. Thank you.
jumping, driving caballero. He ain't got no dinero, but he's Mexico's hep cat, strictly on the solid side. How he can go, that sharp and mellow caballero. He gave up the bolero, and he digs every step that makes you want a boogie ride. He went to Manhattan this Latin to show them his rumba routine. He went up to Harlem one day, now he's jumping like a jumping bean. Oh, 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 Mexico Joe, the jumping, driving caballero. He came back to the border, and he captured his daughter down below the Rio Grande. Thank you.
was a segue to go back in time. We're going to go back to the 40s with the Andrews Sisters, Boogie Woogie, Bugle Boy of Company B, then Benny Hill and his orchestra. Benny Hill. Benny Goodman with his orchestra with Bumblebee Stomp and Sing, Sing, Sing with the Swing.
From all Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was a top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand, because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a toot-de-la-da-toot. He blows it into the bar. In boogie rhythm, he can't blow a note unless the bass and guitar is playing with him. He makes a company jump when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. He was a boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. Plays boogie woogie bugle, he was busy as a buzz bee. And when he plays, he makes the company jump A to the bar. He's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Do 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 da da do da da do do. He blows it A to the bar. He can't blow a note if the bass and guitar isn't with him. And the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Boogie every night and wakes them up the same way in the early bright. They clap their hands and stamp their feet because they know how he plays when someone gives him a beat. He really breaks it up when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll have Count Basie take us to top of the hour. Count Basie, you ever seen the movie Blazing Saddles when they're going across the desert? It was Count Basie's orchestra right there. That was hilarious.